A grown man like myself found it pleasant to know that a call on the telephone to Mrs. Amworth's house, not 100 yards off, and an inquiry as to whether I might come over after dinner for a game of piquet before bedtime, would probably evoke a responsive welcome. There she would be, with a comrade-like eagerness for companionship, and there was a glass of port and cup of coffee and a cigarette and game of piquet. She played the piano, too, in a free and exuberant manner, and had a charming voice and sang to her own accompaniment. And as the days grew long and the light lingered late, we played our game in her garden, which in the course of a few months she had turned from being a nursery for slugs and snails into a glowing patch of luxuriant blossoming. She was always cheery and jolly. She was interested in everything, and in music, in gardening, in games of all sorts, was a competent performer. Everybody, with one exception, liked her. Everybody felt her to bring with her the tonic of a sunny day. That one exception was Francis Urquham. He, though he confessed he did not like her, acknowledged that he was vastly interested in her. This always seemed strange to me, for pleasant and jovial as she was, I could see nothing in her that could call forth conjecture or intrigued surmise. So healthy and unmysterious a figure did she present. But of the genuineness of Urquham's interest there could be no doubt. One could see him watching and scrutinizing her. In matter of age, she frankly volunteered the information that she was 45, but her briskness, her activity, her unravaged skin, her coal-black hair made it difficult to believe that she was not adopting an unusual device, and adding 10 years onto her age instead of subtracting them. Often also, as our quite unsentimental friendship ripened, Mrs. Amworth would ring me up and propose her advent. If I was busy writing, I was to give her, so we definitely bargained, a frank negative, and in answer, I could hear her jolly laugh and her wishes for a successful evening of work. Sometimes, before her proposal arrived, Urquham would already have stepped across from his house opposite for a smoke and a chat, and he, hearing who my intending visitor was, always urged me to beg her to come. She and I should play our piquet, said he, and he would look on, if we did not object, and learn something of the game. But I doubt whether he paid much attention to it, for nothing could be clearer than that, under that penthouse of forehead and thick eyebrows, his attention was fixed not on the cards, but on one of the players. But he seemed to enjoy an hour spent thus, and often, until one particular evening in July, he would watch her with the air of a man who has some deep problem in front of him. She, enthusiastically keen about our game, seemed not to notice his scrutiny. Then came that evening, when, as I see in the light of subsequent events, began the first twitching of the veil that hid the secret horror from my eyes. I did not know it then, though I noticed that, thereafter, if she rang up to propose coming round, she always asked not only if I was at leisure, but whether Mr. Urquham was with me. If so, she said, she would not spoil the chat of two old bachelors, and laughingly wish me good night. Urquham, on this occasion, had been with me for some half hour before Mrs. Amworth's appearance, and had been talking to me about the medieval beliefs concerning vampirism, one of those borderland subjects which he declared had not been sufficiently studied before it had been consigned by the medical profession to the dust heap of exploded superstitions. There he sat, grim and eager, tracing with that pellucid clearness which had made him in his Cambridge days so admirable a lecturer, the history of those mysterious visitations. In them all, there were the same general features. One of those ghoulish spirits took up its abode in a living man or woman, conferring supernatural powers of bat-like flight and glutting itself with nocturnal blood feasts. When its host died, it continued to dwell in the corpse, which remained undecayed. By day it rested, by night it left the grave and went on its awful errands. No European country in the Middle Ages seemed to have escaped them. Earlier yet, parallels were to be found in Roman and Greek and in Jewish history. "It's a large order to set all that evidence aside as being moonshine," he said. "Hundreds of totally independent witnesses in many ages have testified to the occurrence of these phenomena, and there's no explanation known to me which covers all the facts. And if you feel inclined to say, why then, if these are facts, do we not come across them now? There are two answers I can make you. One is that there were diseases known in the Middle Ages, such as the Black Death, which were certainly existent then and which have become extinct since. But for that reason, we do not assert that such diseases never existed. Just as the Black Death visited England and decimated the population of Norfolk, so here in this very district about 300 years ago, there was certainly an outbreak of vampirism, and Maxley was the centre of it. My second answer is even more convincing, for I tell you that vampirism is by no means extinct now. An outbreak of it certainly occurred in India a year or two ago. At that moment, I heard my knock applied in the cheerful and peremptory manner in which Mrs. Amworth is accustomed to announce her arrival, and I went to the door to open it. "Come in at once," I said, "and save me from having my blood curdled. Mr. Urquhart has been trying to alarm me." Instantly her vital, voluminous presence seemed to fill the room. "Ah, but how lovely," she said. "I delight in having my blood curdled. Go on with your ghost story, Mr. Urquhart. I adore ghost stories." I saw that, as his habit was, he was intently observing her. "It wasn't a ghost story exactly," said he. "I was only telling our host how vampirism was not extinct yet. I was saying that there was an outbreak of it in India only a few years ago." There was a more than perceptible pause, and I saw that, if Urquhart was observing her, she on her side was observing him with fixed eye and parted mouth. Then her jolly laugh invaded that rather tense silence. "Oh, what a shame," she said. "You're not going to curdle my blood at all. Where did you pick up such a tale, Mr. Urquhart? I have lived for years in India and never heard a rumour of such a thing. Some storyteller in the bazaars must have invented it. They are famous at that." I could see that Urquhart was on the point of saying something further, but checked himself. "Ah, very likely that was it," he said. But something had disturbed our usual peaceful sociability that night, and something had damped Mrs. Amworth's usual high spirits. She had no gusto for her piquet, and left after a couple of games. Urquhart had been silent too. Indeed, he hardly spoke again till she departed. "That was unfortunate," he said, "for the outbreak of a very mysterious disease, let us call it, took place at Peshawar, where she and her husband were, and..." "Well?" I asked. "He was one of the victims of it," said he. "Naturally, I had quite forgotten that when I spoke." The summer was unreasonably hot and rainless, and Maxley suffered much from drought, and also from a plague of big black night-flying gnats, the bite of which was very irritating and virulent. They came sailing in of an evening, settling on one's skin so quietly that one perceived nothing till the sharp stab announced that one had been bitten. They did not bite the hands or face, but chose always the neck and throat for their feeding ground, and most of us, as the poison spread, assumed a temporary goiter. Then about the middle of August appeared the first of those mysterious cases of illness which our local doctor attributed to the long-continued heat, coupled with the bite of these venomous insects. The patient was a boy of 16 or 17, the son of Mrs. Amworth's gardener, and the symptoms were an anemic pallor and a languid prostration, accompanied by great drowsiness and an abnormal appetite. He had, too, on his throat, two small punctures where, so Dr. Ross conjectured, one of these great gnats had bitten him. But the odd thing was that there was no swelling or inflammation round the place where he had been bitten. The heat at this time had begun to abate, but the cooler weather failed to restore him, and the boy, in spite of the quantity of good food which he so ravenously swallowed, wasted away to a skin-clad skeleton. I met Dr. Ross in the street one afternoon about this time, and in answer to my inquiries about his patient, he said that he was afraid the boy was dying. The case, he confessed, completely puzzled him. Some obscure form of pernicious anemia was all he could suggest. But he wondered whether Mr. Urquhart would consent to see the boy, on the chance of his being able to throw some new light on the case, and since Urquhart was dining with me that night, I proposed to Dr. Ross to join us. He could not do this, but said he would look in later. When he came, Urquhart at once consented to put his skill at the other's disposal, and together they went off at once. Being thus shorn of my sociable evening, I telephoned to Mrs. Amworth to know if I might inflict myself on her for an hour. Her answer was a welcoming affirmative, and between PK and music, the hour lengthened itself into two. She spoke of the boy who was lying so desperately and mysteriously ill, and told me that she had often been to see him, taking him nourishing and delicate food. But today, and her kind eyes moistened as she spoke, she was afraid she had paid her last visit. Knowing the antipathy between her and Urquhart, I did not tell her that he had been called into consultation. And when I returned home, she accompanied me to my door, for the sake of a breath of night air, and in order to borrow a magazine which contained an article on gardening which she wished to read. "Ah, this delicious night air," she said, luxuriously sniffing in the coolness. "Night air and gardening are the great tonics. There is nothing so stimulating as bare contact with rich Mother Earth. You are never so fresh as when you have been grubbing in the soil. Black hands, black nails, and boots covered with mud." She gave her great jovial laugh. "I'm a glutton for air and earth," she said. "Positively, I look forward to death, for then I shall be buried and have the kind earth all round me. No leaden caskets for me. I have given explicit directions. But what shall I do about air?" "Well, I suppose one can't have everything. The magazine?" "A thousand thanks. I will faithfully return it. Good night. Garden and keep your windows open, and you won't have anemia." "I always sleep with my windows open," said I. I went straight up to my bedroom, of which one of the windows looks out over the street, and as I undressed, I thought I heard voices talking outside not far away. But I paid no particular attention, put out my lights, and falling asleep plunged into the depths of a most horrible dream, distortedly suggested, no doubt, by my last words with Mrs. Amworth. I dreamed that I woke, and found that both my bedroom windows were shut. Half suffocating, I dreamed that I sprang out of bed and went across to open them. The blind over the first was drawn down, and pulling it up, I saw, with the indescribable horror of incipient nightmare, Mrs. Amworth's face suspended close to the pane in the darkness outside, nodding and smiling at me. Pulling down the blind again to keep that terror out, I rushed to the second window on the other side of the room, and there again was Mrs. Amworth's face. Then the panic came upon me in full blast. Here was I suffocating in the airless room, and whichever window I opened, Mrs. Amworth's face would float in, like those noiseless black gnats that bit before one was aware. The nightmare rose to a screaming point, and with strangled yells, I awoke to find my room cool and quiet with both windows open and blinds up, and a half moon high in its course, casting an oblong of tranquil light on the floor. But even when I was awake, the horror persisted, and I lay tossing and turning. I must have slept long before the nightmare seized me, for now it was nearly day, and soon in the east the drowsy eyelids of morning began to lift. I was scarcely downstairs next morning, for after the dawn I slept late, when Urquhart rang up to know if he might see me immediately. He came in, grim and preoccupied, and I noticed that he was pulling on a pipe that was not even filled. "I want your help," he said, "and so I must tell you first of all what happened last night. I went round with the little doctor to see his patient, and found him just alive, but scarcely more. I instantly diagnosed in my own mind what this anemia, unaccountable by any other explanation, meant. The boy is the prey of a vampire." He put his empty pipe on the breakfast table, by which I had just sat down, and folded his arms, looking at me steadily from under his overhanging brows. "Now, about last night," he said, "I insisted that he should be moved from his father's cottage into my house. As we were carrying him on a stretcher, whom should we meet but Mrs. Amworth? She expressed shocked surprise that we were moving him. Now, why do you think she did that?" With a start of horror, as I remembered my dream that night before, I felt an idea come into my mind so preposterous and unthinkable that I instantly turned it out again. "I haven't the smallest idea," I said. "Then listen while I tell you about what happened later." I put out all light in the room where the boy lay and watched. One window was a little open, for I had forgotten to close it, and about midnight I heard something outside, trying apparently to push it farther open. I guessed who it was. Yes, it was full 20 feet from the ground, and I peeped round the corner of the blind. Just outside was the face of Mrs. Amworth, and her hand was on the frame of the window. Very softly I crept close, and then banged the window down, and I think I just caught the tip of one of her fingers. "But it's impossible," I cried. "How could she be floating in the air like that? And what has she come for? Don't tell me such." Once more, with closer grip, the remembrance of my nightmare seized me. "I am telling you what I saw," said he, "and all night long, until it was nearly day, she was fluttering outside like some terrible bat trying to gain admittance. Now put together various things I have told you." He began checking them off on his fingers. "1, he said, "there was an outbreak of disease similar to that which this boy is suffering from at Peshawar, and her husband died of it. 2, Mrs. Amworth protested against my moving the boy to my house. 3, she, or the demon that inhabits her body, a creature powerful and deadly, tries to gain admittance. And add this too. In medieval times, there was an epidemic of vampirism here at Maxley. The vampire, so the accounts run, was found to be Elizabeth Chaston. I see you remember Mrs. Amworth's maiden name. Finally, the boy is stronger this morning. He would certainly not have been alive if he had been visited again. And what do you make of it?" There was a long silence, during which I found this incredible horror assuming the hues of reality. "I have something to add," I said, "which may or may not bear on it. You say that the spectre went away shortly before dawn."
"Yes."
I told him of my dream, and he smiled grimly.
"Yes, you did well to awake," he said. "That warning came from your subconscious self, which never wholly slumbers, and cried out to you of deadly danger. For 2 reasons, then, you must help me. 1, to save others, the 2nd, to save yourself."
"What do you want me to do?" I asked.
"I want you, first of all, to help me in watching this boy, and ensuring that she does not come near him. Eventually, I want you to help me in tracking the thing down, in exposing and destroying it. It is not human. It is an incarnate fiend. What steps you shall have to take, I don't yet know."
It was now 11 of the forenoon, and presently I went across to his house for a 12-hour vigil while he slept, to come on duty again that night, so that for the next 24 hours either Urquhart or myself was always in the room with the boy, now getting stronger every hour, was lying. The day following was Saturday, and a morning of brilliant, pellucid weather, and already, when I went across to his house to resume my duty, the stream of motors down to Brighton had begun. Simultaneously, I saw Urquhart with a cheerful face, which boded good news of his patient, coming out of his house, and Mrs. Amworth with a gesture of salutation to me and a basket in her hand, walking up the broad strip of grass which bordered the road. There we all three met. I noticed, and saw that Urquhart noticed it too, that one finger of her left hand was bandaged.
"Good morning to you both," said she. "And I hear your patient is doing well, Mr. Urquhart. I have come to bring him a bowl of jelly and to sit with him for an hour. He and I are great friends. I am overjoyed at his recovery."
Urquhart paused a moment, as if making up his mind, and then shot out a pointing finger at her.
"I forbid that," he said. "You shall not sit with him or see him, and you know the reason as well as I do."
I have never seen so horrible a change pass over a human face as that which now blanched hers to the colour of a grey mist. She put up her hands as if to shield herself from the pointing finger, which drew the sign of the cross in the air, and shrank back, cowering onto the road. There was a wild hoot from a horn,
a grinding of brakes, a shout too late from a passing car, and one long scream suddenly cut short. Her body rebounded from the roadway after the first wheel had gone over it, and the second followed. It lay there, quivering and twitching, and was still. She was buried 3 days afterwards in the cemetery outside Maxley, in accordance with the wishes she had told me that she had devised about her interment, and the shock which her sudden and awful death had caused to the little community began by degrees to pass off. To two people only, Irkham and myself, the horror of it was mitigated from the first by the nature of the relief that her death brought, but naturally enough, we kept our own counsel, and no hint of what greater horror had been thus averted was ever let slip. But oddly enough, so it seemed to me, he was still not satisfied about something in connection with her, and would give no answer to my questions on the subject. Then, as the days of a tranquil, mellow September and the October that followed began to drop away like the leaves of the yellowing trees, uneasiness relaxed. But before the entry of November, the seeming tranquillity broke into hurricane. I had been dining one night at the far end of the village, and about 11 o'clock was walking home again. The moon was of an unusual brilliance, rendering all that it shone on as distinct as in some etching. I had just come opposite the house which Mrs. Amworth had occupied, where there was a board up telling that it was to let, when I heard the click of her front gate, and next moment I saw, with a sudden chill and quaking of my very spirit, that she stood there. Her profile, vividly illuminated, was turned to me, and I could not be mistaken in my identification of her. She appeared not to see me. Indeed, the shadow of the yew hedge in front of her garden enveloped me in its blackness, and she went swiftly across the road and entered the gate of the house directly opposite. There I lost sight of her completely. My breath was coming in short pants as if I had been running, and now indeed I ran, with fearful backward glances, along the 100 yards that separated me from my house and Irkham's. It was to his that my flying steps took me, and next minute I was within. "What have you come to tell me?" he asked. "Or shall I guess?" "You can't guess," said I. "No, it's no guess. She has come back, and you have seen her. Tell me about it." I gave him my story. "That's Major Purcell's house," he said. "Come back with me there at once." "But what can we do?" I asked. "I've no idea. That's what we have got to find out." A minute later, we were opposite the house. When I had passed it before, it was all dark. Now lights gleamed from a couple of windows upstairs. Even as we faced it, the front door opened, and next moment Major Purcell emerged from the gate. He saw us and stopped. "I'm on my way to Dr. Ross," he said quickly. "My wife has been taken suddenly ill. She had been in bed an hour when I came upstairs, and I found her white as a ghost and utterly exhausted. She had been to sleep, it seemed, but you will excuse me." "One moment, Major," said Irkham. "Was there any mark on her throat?" "How did you guess that?" said he. "There was. One of those beastly gnats must have bitten her twice there. She was streaming with blood." "And there's someone with her?" asked Irkham. "Yes, I roused her maid." He went off, and Irkham turned to me. "I now know what we have to do," he said. "Change your clothes, and I'll join you at your house." "What is it?" I asked. "I'll tell you on our way. We're going to the cemetery." He carried a pick, a shovel, and a screwdriver when he rejoined me and wore round his shoulders a long coil of rope. As we walked, he gave me the outlines of the ghastly hour that lay before us. "What I have to tell you," he said, "will seem to you now too fantastic for credence, but before dawn we shall see whether it outstrips reality. By a most fortunate happening, you saw the spectre, the astral body, whatever you choose to call it, of Mrs. Amworth, going on its grisly business, and therefore, beyond doubt, the vampire spirit which abode in her during life animates her again in death. That is not exceptional. Indeed, all these weeks since her death I have been expecting it. If I am right, we shall find her body undecayed and untouched by corruption." But she has been dead nearly 2 months, said I. If she had been dead 2 years, it would still be so, if the vampire has possession of her. So remember, whatever you see done, it will be done not to her, who in the natural course would now be feeding the grasses above her grave, but to a spirit of untold evil and malignancy, which gives a phantom life to her body. But what shall I see done? Said I. I will tell you. We know that now, at this moment, the vampire clad in her mortal semblance is out, dining out. But it must get back before dawn, and it will pass into the material form that lies in her grave. We must wait for that, and then with your help I shall dig up her body. If I am right, you will look on her as she was in life, with the full vigor of the dreadful nutriment she has received pulsing in her veins. And then, when dawn has come, and the vampire cannot leave the lair of her body, I shall strike her with this. And he pointed to his pick, through the heart, and she, who comes to life again only with animation the fiend gives her, she and her hellish partner will be dead indeed. Then we must bury her again, delivered at last. We had come to the cemetery, and in the brightness of the moonshine there was no difficulty in identifying her grave. It lay some 20 yards from the small chapel, in the porch of which, obscured by shadow, we concealed ourselves. From there we had a clear and open sight of the grave, and now we must wait till its infernal visitor returned home. The night was warm and windless, yet even if a freezing wind had been raging, I think I should have felt nothing of it, so intense was my preoccupation as to what the night and dawn would bring. There was a bell in the turret of the chapel that struck the quarters of the hour, and it amazed me to find how swiftly the chimes succeeded one another. The moon had long set, but a twilight of stars shone in a clear sky when 5 o'clock of the morning sounded from the turret. A few minutes more passed, and then I felt Urquhart's hand softly nudging me, and looking out in the direction of his pointing finger, I saw that the form of a woman, tall and large in build, was approaching from the right. Noiselessly, with a motion more of gliding and floating than walking, she moved across the cemetery to the grave which was the centre of our observation. She moved round it, as if to be certain of its identity, and for a moment stood directly facing us. In the greyness to which now my eyes had grown accustomed, I could easily see her face and recognise its features. She drew her hand across her mouth as if wiping it, and broke into a chuckle of such laughter as made my hair stir on my head. Then she leaped onto the grave, holding her hands high above her head, and inch by inch disappeared into the earth. Urquhart's hand was laid on my arm, in an injunction to keep still, but now he removed it. "Come," he said. With pick and shovel and rope we went to the grave. The earth was light and sandy, and soon after 6 struck, we had delved down to the coffin lid. With his pick, he loosened the earth round it, and, adjusting the rope through the handles by which it had been lowered, we tried to raise it. This was a long and laborious business, and the light had begun to herald day in the east before we had it out, and lying by the side of the grave. With his screwdriver, he loosened the fastenings of the lid and slid it aside, and standing there, we looked on the face of Mrs. Amworth. The eyes, once closed in death, were open. The cheeks were flushed with colour. The red, full-lipped mouth seemed to smile. "One blow and it's all over," he said. "You need not look." Even as he spoke, he took up the pick again, and, laying the point of it on her left breast, measured his distance. And though I knew what was coming, I could not look away. He grasped the pick in both hands, raised it an inch or two for the taking of his aim, and then with full force brought it down on her breast. A fountain of blood, though she had been dead so long, spouted high in the air, falling with a thud of a heavy splash over the shroud, and simultaneously from those red lips came one long, appalling cry, swelling up like some hooting siren, and dying away again. With that, instantaneous as a lightning flash, came the touch of corruption on her face. The color of it faded to ash. The plump cheeks fell in. The mouth dropped. "Thank God that's over," said he, and without pause slipped the coffin lid back into its place. Day was coming fast now, and, working like men possessed, we lowered the coffin into its place again and shoveled the earth over it. The birds were busy with their earliest pipings as we went back to Maxley.
Dr. Porthos by Basil Copper. Basil Copper, born in 1924, was born in London and had a long career as a journalist and newspaper editor. His first work of fiction was published in 1938. Although a prolific author of supernatural and horror fiction, Copper did not publish work in this genre until 1964, when The Spider saw print in the fifth Pan Book of Horror Stories. Copper has written a great deal of mystery fiction, including 8 short story collections and a novel about Solar Pons, the Sherlock Holmes-like detective created by August Derleth, and more than 50 novels about a Los Angeles-based private detective, Mike Faraday, produced at the rate of at least 2 volumes a year between 1966 and 1988. This series has the predictable shortcomings to be expected of an author who never visited the United States. It is in the horror field that Copper has had his greatest success, with such works as Not After Nightfall, 1967, From Evil's Pillow, 1973, The Curse of the Fleers, 1976, Necropolis, 1977, and Here Be Demons, 1978. Many of his stories have been adapted for radio and television productions. He wrote a highly praised television script based on M.R. James's classic horror story, Count Magnus. He has also written 2 significant works of nonfiction, The Vampire in Legend, Fact, and Art, 1973, and The Werewolf in Legend, Fact, and Art, 1977. Dr. Porthos was first published in The Midnight People, edited by Peter Haining, London, Leslie Frewin, 1968.
Dr. Porthos by Basil Copper, read by Steve West. Part 1. Nervous stability, the doctor says. And yet Angelina has never been ill in her life. Nervous stability? Something far more powerful is involved here. I am left wondering if I should not call in specialist advice. Yet we are so remote, and Dr. Porthos is well spoken of by the local people. Why on earth did we ever come to this house? Angelina was perfectly well until then. It is extraordinary to think that 2 months can have wrought such a change in my wife. In the town she was lively and vivacious, yet now I can hardly bear to look at her without profound emotion. Her cheeks are sunken and pale, her eyes dark and tired, her bloom quite gone at 25. Could it be something in the air of the house? It seems barely possible. But in that case, Dr. Porthos' ministrations should have proved effective. But so far all his skills have been powerless to produce any change for the better. If it had not been for the terms of my uncle's will, we would never have come at all. Friends may call it cupidity, the world may think what it chooses, but the plain truth is that I needed the money. My own health is far from robust, and long hours in the family business, ours is an honored and well-established counting house, had made it perfectly clear to me that I must seek some other mode of life. And yet I could not afford to retire. The terms of my uncle's will, as retailed to me by the family solicitor, afforded the perfect solution. An annuity. A handsome annuity, to put it bluntly, but with the proviso that my wife and I should reside in the old man's house for a period of not less than 5 years from the date the terms of the will became effective. I hesitated long. Both my wife and I were fond of town life, and my uncle's estate was in a remote area, where living for the country people was primitive and amenities few. As I had understood it from the solicitor, the house itself had not even the benefit of gas lighting. In summer it was not so bad, but the long months of winter would be melancholy indeed, with only the glimmer of candles and the pale sheen of oil lamps to relieve the gloom of the lonely old place. I debated with Angelina, and then set off one weekend alone for a tour of the estate. I had cabled ahead, and after a long and cold railway journey, which itself occupied most of the day, I was met at my destination by a horse and chaise. The next part of my pilgrimage occupied nearly 4 hours, and I was dismayed on seeing into what a wild and remote region my uncle had chosen to penetrate in order to select a dwelling. The night was dark, but the moon occasionally burst its veiling of cloud to reveal in feeble detail the contours of rock and hill and tree. The chaise jolted and lurched over an unmade road, which was deeply rutted by the wheels of the few vehicles which had torn up the surface in their passing over many months. My solicitor had wired an old friend, Dr. Porthos, to whose good offices I owed my mode of transport, and he had promised to greet me on arrival at the village nearest the estate. Sure enough, he came out from under the great porch of the timbered hostelry as our carriage grated into the inn-yard. He was a tall, spare man, with square pince-nez which sat firmly on his thin nose. He wore a many-pleated cape like an ostler, and the green top hat, worn rakishly over one eye, gave him a somewhat dissipated look. He greeted me effusively, but there was something about the man which did not endear him to me. There was nothing that one could isolate. It was just his general manner, perhaps the coldness of his hand which struck my palm with the clamminess of a fish. Then, too, his eyes had a most disconcerting way of looking over the tops of his glasses. They were a filmy grey, and their piercing glance seemed to root one to the spot. To my dismay, I learned that I was not yet at my destination. The estate was still some way off, said the doctor, and we would have to stay the night at the inn. My ill temper at his remarks was soon dispelled by the roaring fire and the good food which he plied me with. There were few travellers at this time of year, and we were the only ones taking dinner in the vast oak-panelled dining-room. The doctor had been my uncle's medical attendant, and though it was many years since I had seen my relative, I was curious to know what sort of person he had been. "The Baron was a great man in these parts," said Porthos. His genial manner emboldened me to ask a question to which I had long been awaiting an answer. "Of what did my uncle die?" I asked. Firelight flickered through the gleaming redness of Dr. Porthos's wine-glass and tinged his face with amber as he replied simply, "Of a lacking of richness in the blood. Fatal quality in his immediate line, I might say." I pondered for a moment. "Why do you think he chose me as his heir?" I added. Dr. Porthos's answer was straight and clear and given without hesitation. "You are a different branch of the family," he said. "New blood, my dear sir. The Baron was most particular on that account. He wanted to carry on the great tradition." He cut off any further questions by rising abruptly. "Those were the Baron's own words as he lay dying, and now we must retire as we still have a fair journey before us in the morning." Part 2. Dr. Porthos's words come back to me in my present trouble. Blood. New blood. What if this be concerned with those dark legends the local people tell about the house? One hardly knows what to think in this atmosphere. My inspection of the house with Dr. Porthos confirmed my worst fears. Sagging lintels, mouldering cornices, worm-eaten panelling. The only servitors, a middle-aged couple, husband and wife, who have been caretakers here since the Baron's death, the local people sullen and uncooperative, so Porthos says. Certainly the small hamlet a mile or so from the mansion had every door and window shut as we clattered past, and not a soul was stirring. The house has a Gothic beauty, I suppose. Viewed from a distance, it is of no great age, being largely rebuilt on the remains of an older pile destroyed by fire. The restorer, whether he be my uncle or some older resident I have not bothered to discover, had the fancy of adding turrets, a drawbridge with castellated towers, and a moated surround. Our footsteps echoed mournfully over this as we turned to inspect the grounds. I was surprised to see marble statuary and worn obelisks all tumbled and awry, as though the uneasy dead were bursting from the soil, protruding over an ancient moss-grown wall adjoining the courtyard of the house. Dr. Porthos smiled sardonically. "The old family burial ground," he explained. "Your uncle is interred here. He said he likes to be near the house." Part 3. Well, it is done. We came not 2 months since, and then began the profound and melancholy change of which I have already spoken. not just the atmosphere, though the very stones of this house seem steeped in evil whispers, but the surroundings, the dark, unmoving trees, even the furniture, seem to exude something inimical to life as we knew it, as it is still known to those fortunate enough to dwell in towns. A poisonous mist rises from the moat at dusk. It seems to doubly emphasize our isolation. The presence of Angelina's own maid and a handyman who was in my father's employ before me does little to dispel the ambiance of this place. Even their sturdy matter-of-factness seems affected by a miasma that wells from the pores of the building. It has become so manifest of late that I even welcome the daily visits of Dr. Porthos, despite the fact that I suspect him to be the author of our troubles. They began a week after our arrival when Angelina failed to awake by my side as usual. I shook her to arouse her, and my screams must have awakened the maid. I think I fainted then and came to myself in the great morning room. The bed had been awash with blood, which stained the sheets and pillows around my dear wife's head. Porthos's curious grey eyes had a steely look in them which I had never seen before. He administered a powerful medicine and had then turned to attend to me. Whatever had attacked Angelina had teeth like the sharpest canine, Porthos said. He had found two distinct punctures in Angelina's throat, sufficient to account for the quantities of blood. Indeed, there had been so much of it that my own hands and linen were stained with it where I had touched her. I think it was this which had made me cry so violently. Porthos had announced that he would sit up by the patient that night. Angelina was still asleep, as I discovered when I tiptoed in later. Porthos had administered a sleeping draught, and had advised me to take the same to settle my nerves, but I declined. I said I would wait up with him. The doctor had some theory about rats or other nocturnal creatures, and sat long in the library looking through some of the Baron's old books on natural history. The man's attitude puzzled me. What sort of creature would attack Angelina in her own bedroom? Looking at Porthos's strange eyes, my old fears are beginning to return, bringing with them new ones. Part 4. There have been three more attacks extending over a fortnight. My darling grows visibly weaker. Though Porthos had been to the nearest town for more powerful drugs and other remedies, I am in purgatory. I have not known such dark hours in my life until now. Yet Angelina herself insists that we should stay to see this grotesque nightmare through. The first evening of our vigil, both Porthos and I slept, and in the morning the result was as the night before. Considerable emissions of blood and the bandage covering the wound had been removed to allow the creature access to the punctures. I hardly dare conjecture what manner of beast could have done this. I was quite worn out, and on the evening of the next day I agreed to Porthos's suggestion that I should take a sleeping draught. Nothing happened for several nights, and Angelina began to recover. Then the terror struck again. And so it will go on, my reeling senses tell me. I daren't trust Porthos, and on the other hand I cannot accuse him before the members of my household. We are isolated here, and any mistake I make might be fatal. On the last occasion I almost had him. I woke at dawn and found Porthos stretched on the bed, his long, dark form quivering, his hands at Angelina's throat. I struck at him, for I did not know who it was, being half asleep, and he turned, his grey eyes glowing in the dim room. He had a hypodermic syringe half full of blood in his hand. I'm afraid I dashed it to the floor and shattered it beneath my heel. In my own heart, I am convinced I have caught this creature which has been plaguing us. But how to prove it? Dr. Porthos is staying in the house now. I dare not sleep and continually refuse the potions he urgently presses upon me. How long before he destroys me as well as Angelina? Was man ever in such an appalling situation since the world began? I sit and watch Porthos, who stares at me sideways with those curious eyes, his inexpressive face seeming to hint that he can afford to watch and wait and that his time is coming. My pale wife, in her few intervals of consciousness, sits and fearfully watches both of us. Yet I cannot even confide in her, for she would think me mad. I try to calm my racing brain. Sometimes I think I shall go insane altogether. The nights are so long. God help me. Part 5. It is over. The crisis has come and gone. I have laid the mad demon which has us in thrall. I caught him at it. Porthos writhed as I got my hands at his throat. I would have killed him at his foul work. The syringe glinted in his hand. Now he has slipped aside, eluded me for the moment. My cries brought in the servants who have my express instructions to hunt him down. He shall not escape me this time. I pace the corridors of this worm-eaten mansion, and when I have cornered him, I shall destroy him. Angelina shall live, and my hands will perform the healing work of his destruction. But now I must rest. Already it is dawn again. I will sit in this chair by the pillar, where I can watch the hall. I sleep. Part 6. Later. I awake to pain and cold. I am lying on earth. Something slippery trickles over my hand. I open my eyes. I draw my hand across my mouth. It comes away scarlet. I can see more clearly now. Angelina is here too. She looks terrified, but somehow sad and composed. She is holding the arm of Dr. Porthos. He is poised above me, his face looking satanic in the dim light of the crypt beneath the house. He whirls a mallet while shriek after shriek disturbs the silence of this place. Dear Christ, the stake is against my breast!
For the Blood is the Life by F. Marion Crawford. Frances Marion Crawford, 1854-1909, was born in Bagni di Lucca, Italy, the son of American parents and the nephew of the famous poet Julia Ward Howe. He studied at Cambridge, Heidelberg, and Rome. When he was 25, he went to India to study Sanskrit and continued its study at Harvard. His first novel, Mr. Isaacs, 1882, was an immediately popular sketch of Anglo-Indian life. He returned to Italy the following year, making it his permanent residence. One of the most commercially successful authors of his day, Crawford wrote more than 40 books, mostly in the Romantic tradition, frequently using supernatural and mystical themes, notably in his first novel, Khaled, A Tale of Arabia, 1891, and the horror tale, The Witch of Prague, 1891. Corleone, 1897, was the first novel to feature the mafia, and also the first to use the plot device of a priest unable to testify about criminal activity because of the strictures of confession. Mario Puzo used the now familiar Corleone name for the primary family in The Godfather, 1969. In spite of their once great popularity, Crawford's novels are seldom read today, his name kept alive only through a handful of first-rate short stories. For the Blood is the Life was first published in the December 16, 1905 issue of Collier's Magazine. It was first collected in book form in Wandering Ghosts, New York, Macmillan, 1911, which was published 2 weeks earlier in London as Uncanny Tales, Unwin, 1911.
For the Blood is the Life by F. Marion Crawford. Read by Jonathan Cowley. He had dined at sunset on the broad roof of the old tower, because it was cooler there during the great heat of summer. Besides, the little kitchen was built at one corner of the great square platform, which made it more convenient than if the dishes had to be carried down the steep stone steps, broken in places and everywhere worn with age. The tower was one of those built all down the west coast of Calabria by the Emperor Charles V, early in the 16th century, to keep off the Barbary pirates, when the unbelievers were allied with Francis I against the Emperor and the Church. They have gone to ruin. A few still stand intact, and mine is one of the largest. How it came into my possession 10 years ago, and why I spend a part of each year in it, are matters which do not concern this tale. The tower stands in one of the loneliest spots in southern Italy, at the extremity of a curving rocky promontory, which forms a small but safe natural harbour at the southern extremity of the Gulf of Policastro and is just north of Cape Scalea, the birthplace of Judas Iscariot according to the old local legend. The tower stands alone on this hooked spur of the rock, and there is not a house to be seen within 3 miles of it. When I go there, I take a couple of sailors, one of whom is a fair cook, and when I am away it is in charge of a gnome-like little being who was once a miner and who attached himself to me long ago. My friend, who sometimes visits me in my summer solitude, is an artist by profession, a Scandinavian by birth, and a cosmopolitan by force of circumstances. We had dined at sunset. The sunset glow had reddened and faded again, and the evening purple steeped the vast chain of the mountains that embrace the deep gulf to eastward and rear themselves higher and higher toward the south. It was hot, and we sat at the landward corner of the platform, waiting for the night breeze to come down from the lower hills. The colour sank out of the air. There was a little interval of deep grey twilight, and a lamp sent a yellow streak from the open door of the kitchen, where the men were getting their supper. Then the moon rose suddenly above crest of the promontory, flooding the platform and lighting up every little spur of rock and knoll of grass below us, down to the edge of the motionless water. My friend lighted his pipe and sat looking at a spot on the hillside. I knew that he was looking at it, and for a long time past I had wondered whether he would ever see anything there that would fix his attention. I knew that spot well. It was clear that he was interested at last, though it was a long time before he spoke. Like most painters, he trusts to his own eyesight, as a lion trusts his strength and a stag his speed, and he is always disturbed when he cannot reconcile what he sees with what he believes that he ought to see. "It's strange," he said. "Do you see that little mound just on this side of the boulder?" "Yes," I said, and I guessed what was coming. "It looks like a grave," observed Holger. "Very true, it does look like a grave." "Yes," continued my friend, his eyes still fixed on the spot. "But the strange thing is that I see the body lying on the top of it, of course," continued Holger, turning his head on one side as artists do. "It must be an effect of light. In the first place, it is not a grave at all. Secondly, if it were, the body would be inside and not outside. Therefore, it's an effect of the moonlight. Don't you see it?" "Perfectly. I always see it on moonlit nights." "It doesn't seem to interest you much," said Holger. "On the contrary, it does interest me, though I am used to it. You're not so far wrong either. The mound is really a grave." "Nonsense," cried Holger, incredulously. "I suppose you'll tell me what I see lying on it is really a corpse." "No," I answered, "it's not, I know, because I have taken the trouble to go down and see." "Then what is it?" asked Holger. "It's nothing." "You mean that it's an effect of light, I suppose?" "Perhaps it is, but the inexplicable part of the matter is that it makes no difference whether the moon is rising or setting or waxing or waning. If there's any moonlight at all, from east or west or overhead, as long as it shines on the grave, you can see the outline of the body on top." Holger stirred up his pipe with the point of his knife and then used his finger for a stopper. When the tobacco burned well, he rose from his chair. "If you don't mind," he said, "I'll go down and take a look at it." He left me, crossed the roof, and disappeared down the dark steps. I did not move, but sat looking down until he came out of the tower below. I heard him humming an old Danish song as he crossed the open space in the bright moonlight, going straight to the mysterious mound. When he was 10 paces from it, Holger stopped short, made 2 steps forward, and then 3 or 4 backward, and then stopped again. I know what that meant. He had reached the spot where the thing ceased to be visible, where, as he would have said, the effect of light changed. Then he went on till he reached the mound and stood upon it. I could see the thing still, but it was no longer lying down. It was on its knees now, winding its white arms round Holger's body and looking up into his face. A cool breeze stirred my hair at that moment, as the night wind began to come down from the hills, but it felt like a breath from another world. The thing seemed to be trying to climb to its feet, helping itself up by Holger's body while he stood upright, quite unconscious of it and apparently looking toward the tower, which is very picturesque when the moonlight falls upon it on that side. "Come along," I shouted. "Don't stay there all night." It seemed to me that he moved reluctantly as he stepped from the mound, or else with difficulty. That was it. The thing's arms were still round his waist, but its feet could not leave the grave. As he came slowly forward, it was drawn and lengthened like a wreath of mist, thin and white, till I saw distinctly that Holger shook himself, as a man does who feels a chill. At the same instant, a little wail of pain came to me on the breeze. It might have been the cry of the small owl that lives among the rocks, and the misty presence floated swiftly back from Holger's advancing figure and lay once more at its length upon the mound. Again I felt the cool breeze in my hair, and this time an icy thrill of dread ran down my spine. I remembered very well that I had once gone down there alone in the moonlight, that presently, being near, I had seen nothing, that, like Holger, I had gone and had stood upon the mound. And I remembered how, when I came back, sure that there was nothing there, I had felt the sudden conviction that there was something after all if I would only look behind me. I remembered the strong temptation to look back, a temptation I had resisted as unworthy of a man of sense, until, to get rid of it, I had shaken myself just as Holger did. And now I knew that those white, misty arms had been round me too. I knew it in a flash, and I shuddered as I remembered that I had heard the night owl then too. But it had not been the night owl. It was the cry of the thing. I refilled my pipe and poured out a cup of strong southern wine. In less than a minute, Holger was seated beside me again. "Of course there's nothing there," he said. "But it's creepy all the same. Do you know, when I was coming back, I was so sure that there was something behind me that I wanted to turn round and look. It was an effort not to." He laughed a little, knocked the ashes out of his pipe, and poured himself out some wine. For a while neither of us spoke, and the moon rose higher, and we both looked at the thing that lay on the mound. "You might make a story about that," said Holger after a long time. "There is one," I answered. "If you're not sleepy, I'll tell it to you." "Go ahead," said Holger, who likes stories. Old Ilario was dying up there in the village behind the hill. You remember him, I have no doubt. They say that he made his money by selling sham jewellery in South America, and escaped with his gains when he was found out. Like all those fellows, if they bring anything back with them, he at once set to work to enlarge his house. And as there are no masons here, he sent all the way to Paolo for two workmen. They were a rough-looking pair of scoundrels, a Neapolitan who had lost one eye, and a Sicilian with an old scar half an inch deep across his left cheek. I often saw them, for on Sundays they used to come down here and fish off the rocks. When Ilario caught the fever that killed him, the masons were still at work. As he had agreed that part of their pay should be their board and lodging, he made them sleep in the house. His wife was dead, and he had an only son called Angelo, who was a much better sort than himself. Angelo was to marry the daughter of the richest man in the village, and, strange to say, though the marriage was arranged by their parents, the young people were said to be in love with each other. For that matter, the whole village was in love with Angelo, and among the rest a wild, good-looking creature called Cristina, who was more like a gypsy than any girl I ever saw about here. She had very red lips and very black eyes. She was built like a greyhound and had the tongue of the devil. But Angelo did not care a straw for her. He was rather a simple-minded fellow, quite different from his old scoundrel of a father. And under what I should call normal circumstances, I really believe that he would never have looked at any girl except the nice, plump little creature with a fat dowry whom his father meant him to marry. But things turned up which were neither normal nor natural. On the other hand, a very handsome young shepherd from the hills above Maratea was in love with Cristina, who seems to have been quite indifferent to him. Cristina had no regular means of subsistence, but she was a good girl and willing to do any work or go on errands to any distance for the sake of a loaf of bread or mess of beans and permission to sleep undercover. She was especially glad when she could get something to do about the house of Angelo's father. There is no doctor in the village, and when the neighbours saw that old Ilario was dying, they sent Cristina to Scalea to fetch one. That was late in the afternoon, and if they had waited so long, it was because the dying miser refused to allow any such extravagance while he was able to speak. But while Cristina was gone, matters grew rapidly worse. The priest was brought to the bedside, and when he had done what he could, he gave it as his opinion to the bystanders that the old man was dead and left the house. You know these people. They have a physical horror of death. Until the priest spoke, the room had been full of people. The words were hardly out of his mouth before it was empty. It was night now. They hurried down the dark steps and out into the street. Angelo, as I have said, was away. Cristina had not come back. The simple woman servant who had nursed the sick man fled with the rest, and the body was left alone in the flickering light of the earthen oil lamp. 5 minutes later, two men looked in cautiously and crept forward toward the bed. They were the one-eyed Neapolitan mason and his Sicilian companion. They knew what they wanted. In a moment they had dragged from under the bed a small but heavy iron-bound box, and long before anyone thought of coming back to the dead man, they had left the house and the village under cover of the darkness. It was easy enough, for Ilario's house is the last toward the gorge which leads down here, and the thieves merely went out by the back door, got over the stone wall, and had nothing to risk after that except the possibility of meeting some belated countryman, which was very small indeed, since few of the people use that path. They had a mattock and shovel, and they made their way here without accident. I am telling you this story as it must have happened, for, of course, there were no witnesses to this part of it. The men brought the box down by the gorge, intending to bury it until they should be able to come back and take it away in a boat. They must have been clever enough to guess that some of the money would be in paper notes, for they would otherwise have buried it on the beach in the wet sand, where it would have been much safer. But the paper would have rotted if they had been obliged to leave it there long, so they dug their hole down there, close to that boulder. Yes, just where the mound is now. Cristina did not find the doctor in Scalea, for he had been sent for from a place up the valley, halfway to San Domenico. If she had found him, he would have come on his mule by the upper road, which is smoother but much longer. But Cristina took the short cut by the rocks, which passes about 50 feet above the mound and goes round that corner. The men were digging when she passed, and she heard them at work. It would not have been like her to go by without finding out what the noise was, for she was never afraid of anything in her life, and besides, the fishermen sometimes come ashore here at night to get a stone for an anchor, or to gather sticks to make a little fire. The night was dark, and Cristina probably came close to the two men before she could see what they were doing. She knew them, of course, and they knew her, and understood instantly that they were in her power. There was only one thing to be done for their safety, and they did it. They knocked her on the head, they dug the hole deep, and they buried her quickly with the iron-bound chest. They must have understood that their only chance of escaping suspicion lay in getting back to the village before their absence was noticed, for they returned immediately, and were found half an hour later gossiping quietly with the man who was making Ilario's coffin. He was a crony of theirs, and had been working at the repairs in the old man's house. So far as I have been able to make out, the only persons who were supposed to know where Ilario kept his treasure were Angelo and the one woman servant I have mentioned. Angelo was away. It was the woman who discovered the theft. It is easy enough to understand why no one else knew where the money was. The old man kept his door locked and the key in his pocket when he was out, and did not let the woman enter to clean the place unless he was there himself. The whole village knew that he had money somewhere, however, and the masons had probably discovered the whereabouts of the chest by climbing in at the window in his absence. If the old man had not been delirious until he lost consciousness, he would have been in frightful agony of mind for his riches. The faithful woman servant forgot their existence only for a few moments when she fled with the rest, overcome by the horror of death. 20 minutes had not passed before she returned with the two hideous old hags who are always called in to prepare the dead for burial. Even then, she had not at first the courage to go near the bed with them, but she made a pretense of dropping something, went down on her knees as if to find it, and looked under the bedstead. The walls of the room were newly whitewashed down to the floor, and she saw at a glance that the chest was gone. It had been there in the afternoon. It had therefore been stolen in the short interval since she had left the room. There are no carabineers stationed in the village. There is not so much as a municipal watchman, for there is no municipality. There never was such a place, I believe. Scalea is supposed to look after it in some mysterious way, and it takes a couple of hours to get anybody from there. As the old woman had lived in the village all her life, it did not even occur to her to apply to any civil authority for help. She simply set up a howl and ran through the village in the dark, screaming out that her dead master's house had been robbed. Many of the people looked out, but at first no one seemed inclined to help her. Most of them, judging her by themselves, whispered to each other that she had probably stolen the money herself. The first man to move was the father of the girl whom Angelo was to marry, having collected his household, all of whom felt a personal interest in the wealth which was to have come into the family. He declared it to be his opinion that the chest had been stolen by the two journeyman masons who lodged in the house. He headed a search for them, which naturally began in Ilario's house and ended in the carpenter's workshop, where the thieves were found discussing a measure of wine with the carpenter over the half-finished coffin, by the light of one earthen lamp filled with oil and tallow. The search party at once accused the delinquents of the crime and threatened to lock them up in the cellar till the carabineers could be fetched from Scalea. The two men looked at each other for one moment, and then without the slightest hesitation, they put out the single light, seized the unfinished coffin between them, and using it as a sort of battering ram, dashed upon their assailants in the dark. In a few moments, they were beyond pursuit. That is the end of the first part of the story. The treasure had disappeared, and as no trace of it could be found, the people naturally supposed that the thieves had succeeded in carrying it off. The old man was buried, and when Angelo came back at last, he had to borrow money to pay for the miserable funeral, and had some difficulty in doing so. He hardly needed to be told that in losing his inheritance, he had lost his bride. In this part of the world, marriages are made on strictly business principles, and if the promised cash is not forthcoming on the appointed day, the bride or the bridegroom whose parents have failed to produce it may as well take themselves off, for there will be no wedding. Poor Angelo knew that well enough. His father had been possessed of hardly any land, and now that the hard cash which he had brought from South America was gone, there was nothing left but debts for the building materials that were to have been used for enlarging and improving the old house. Angelo was beggared, and the nice plump little creature who was to have been his turned up her nose at him in the most approved fashion. As for Cristina, it was several days before she was missed, for no one remembered that she had been sent to Scalea for the doctor, who had never come. She often disappeared in the same way for days together, when she could find a little work here and there at the distant farms among the hills. But when she did not come back at all, people began to wonder, and at last made up their minds that she had connived with the masons and had escaped with them. I paused and emptied my glass. "That sort of thing could not happen anywhere else," observed Holger, filling his everlasting pipe again. "It is wonderful what a natural charm there is about murder and sudden death in a romantic country like this. Deeds that would be simply brutal and disgusting anywhere else become dramatic and mysterious because this is Italy, and we are living in a genuine tower of Charles V, built against genuine Barbary pirates." "There's something in that," I admitted. "Holger is the most romantic man in the world inside of himself, but he always thinks it necessary to explain why he feels anything." I suppose they found the poor girl's body with the box, he said presently. As it seems to interest you, I answered, I'll tell you the rest of the story. The moon had risen high by this time. The outline of the thing on the mound was clearer to our eyes than before. The village very soon settled down to its small, dull life. No one missed old Ilario, who had been away so much on his voyages to South America that he had never been a familiar figure in his native place. Angelo lived in the half-finished house, and because he had no money to pay the old woman servant, she would not stay with him, but once in a long time she would come and wash a shirt for him for old acquaintance's sake. Besides the house, he had inherited a small patch of ground at some distance from the village. He tried to cultivate it, but he had no heart in the work, for he knew he could never pay the taxes on it and on the house, which would certainly be confiscated by the government, or seized for the debt of the building material, which the man who had supplied it refused to take back. Angelo was very unhappy. So long as his father had been alive and rich, every girl in the village had been in love with him. But that was all changed now. It had been pleasant to be admired and courted, and invited to drink wine by fathers who had girls to marry. It was hard to be stared at coldly, and sometimes laughed at because he had been robbed of his inheritance. He cooked his miserable meals for himself, and from being sad, became melancholy and morose. At twilight, when the day's work was done, instead of hanging about in the open space before the church with young fellows of his own age, he took to wandering in lonely places on the outskirts of the village till it was quite dark. Then he slunk home and went to bed to save the expense of a light. But in those lonely twilight hours he began to have strange waking dreams. He was not always alone, for often, when he sat on the stump of a tree, where the narrow path turns down the gorge, he was sure that a woman came up noiselessly over the rough stones, as if her feet were bare, and she stood under a clump of chestnut trees only half a dozen yards down the path, and beckoned to him without speaking. Though she was in the shadow, he knew that her lips were red, and that when they parted a little and smiled at him, she showed two small sharp teeth. He knew this at first, rather than saw it, and he knew that it was Christina, and that she was dead. Yet he was not afraid. He only wondered whether it was a dream, for he thought that if he had been awake, he should have been frightened. Besides, the dead woman had red lips, and that could only happen in a dream. Whenever he went near the gorge after sunset, she was already there waiting for him, or else she very soon appeared, and he began to be sure that she came a little nearer to him every day. At first he had only been sure of her blood-red mouth, but now each feature grew distinct, and the pale face looked at him with deep and hungry eyes. It was the eyes that grew dim. Little by little he came to know that some day the dream would not end when he turned away to go home, but would lead him down the gorge out of which the vision rose. She was nearer now when she beckoned to him. Her cheeks were not livid like those of the dead, but pale with starvation, with the furious and unappeased physical hunger of her eyes that devoured him. They feasted on his soul and cast a spell over him, and at last they were close to his own and held him. He could not tell whether her breath was as hot as fire or as cold as ice. He could not tell whether her red lips burned his or froze them, or whether her five fingers on his wrists seared scorching scars or bit his flesh like frost. He could not tell whether he was awake or asleep, whether she was alive or dead, but he knew that she loved him, she alone of all creatures, earthly or unearthly, and her spell had power over him. When the moon rose high that night, the shadow of that thing was not alone down there upon the mound. Angelo awoke in the cool dawn, drenched with dew and chilled through flesh and blood and bone. He opened his eyes to the faint grey light and saw the stars still shining overhead. He was very weak, and his heart was beating so slowly that he was almost like a man fainting. Slowly, he turned his head on the mound, as on a pillow, but the other face was not there. Fear seized him suddenly, a fear unspeakable and unknown. He sprang to his feet and fled up the gorge, and he never looked behind him until he reached the door of the house on the outskirts of the village. Drearily, he went to his work that day, and wearily the hours dragged themselves after the sun, till at last it touched the sea and sank, and the great sharp hills above Maratea turned purple against the dove-coloured eastern sky. Angelo shouldered his heavy hoe and left the field. He felt less tired now than in the morning when he had begun to work, but he promised himself that he would go home without lingering by the gorge, and eat the best supper he could get himself,